Welcome to the Agency in Focus, NASA, sponsored by Leidos. Now, here's your host, Tom Temin.
Being an astronaut isn't what it used to be. Contemporary out-of-Earth travelers spend long periods of time on the space station in a semblance of normal daily life, except for the lack of gravity. NASA's Scott Tingle returned in June. He's been making the rounds as part of the agency's 60th anniversary. He spoke in studio with Federal News Radio's Eric White, answering questions such as, what is it like up there?
Well, to me, it was reaffirming. I like to do a lot of things in the outdoors. I like to camp. I like to be with good people. I like to enjoy a cold beer. You know, all those normal things that everybody else does. And when you look, you can look out the window right now, we have a hurricane coming, but you know, it's still got some beauty. You know, you got the trees out there. People are bustling and going to work. The buildings have some really cool design on them. The fog is starting to come in. And it's, you know, it's actually a beautiful day. And so, you know, we know that this place is beautiful. And when we go up into space and you see it in from a much bigger picture, it just reaffirms that, yeah, we got that is the best spaceship ever. And that's Earth.
Tell us how you all got started into this, and you know, is it true that astronauts always have wanted to have that ingrained in their DNA? It's something that they've always wanted to do, or you know, was it something you saw the opportunity and took it?
Yeah, so I think the answer to the last part of your question is it varies depending on who you're talking to. Everybody has different life aspirations and different experiences and many different paths that lead to the NASA Astronaut Corps. And I think that's one of the things that actually makes our office really strong is the diversity that that folks bring into the office for that. In my case, I grew up, you know, I watched the moonwalk with Neil Armstrong really close to my fourth birthday. And I, you know, was sitting there with my mom, and I remember, you know, we were talking about it, and it was really cool. And it was just a seed that planted, and it started to grow over the course of my life. And through some various technical training that I had, I got more and more interested in science, more and more interested in airplanes and things that go fast and extreme things that that we can do to really help the human race. It was all very interesting to me. That led me into becoming an engineer, and also led me into becoming a Navy test pilot, and then led me into becoming an astronaut.
And so when you're, you know, starting out, you said you're a Navy pilot, you're an engineer. Is the goal, you know, was the goal for you at the end, you know, I hope that this will somehow get me into flight school, or, you know, were you just thinking like fingers crossed kind of thing, or how does that work?
Yeah, so for me, the end goal was always the astronaut corps. I wish I had saved them, but I had pieces of paper with the target at the end being an astronaut, and I would map out all the different paths that I could take and which one I wanted to do. And I would actually look and make decisions on what I thought was good and what I thought wasn't good. And it actually got really hard because I really wanted to go get a PhD. I was really interested in science, but I really wanted to fly airplanes off aircraft carriers. That was also very interesting. And there was a part of me that just, you know, wanted to go buy a farm and have a nice quiet life with my family as well. And so it was always a challenge, and there was a tug of war, you know, as you go through your track and to reach your goals. And but you know, every decision I made because at that moment in time, that near-term path was going to be very rewarding for me, whether or not I made it to the end state or not. But I did it with the end state in mind, and then just step by step, we got there.
And you mentioned mom. How did they react when you first told them, I want to be an astronaut, I want to do all these flying missions, I want to do sort of dangerous work? were they receptive? Or?
Well, when I was younger and I kind of started telling them that, hey, I think I want to do that, they were all very supportive. And, you know, you can do anything you want, go for it, and which was great. When I finally got to the point where I got selected for the astronaut corps, my lovely wife started to cry a little bit because she didn't want to move again. You know, we had moved 12 times in 21 years in the Navy, and this would be another move to Houston to do that. But she got used to the idea really fast, and we're really glad we made the jump. My mom always tells any interviews she gives, she always tells everybody that she's really mad at me for doing this because she's never given her permission.
Of course, she needs everything. We're speaking with Scott Tingle. Going into the Navy and everything like that, can you explain to me a little bit about it, that experience and how it prepared you for, you know, we were talking about reacting and expecting the unexpected. I imagine that came into play, well, even as a Navy pilot, not just an astronaut.
Sure, absolutely. But I'll tell you, you know, the Navy's given me pretty much every opportunity that I've had. I never could have got had the life that I've lived and am going to live without the United States Navy. I came from a challenging background, didn't have a whole lot of resources. I had to work real hard and was working two jobs in high school just to save up for my first year of college. The money ran out in the first year of college. So I enlisted in the reserves when I was 18 years old, and that paid for the rest of college and graduate school, which was fantastic. After working as an engineer for a few years and kind of doing some soul searching and figuring out how aggressive I want to go after my goal, I decided to go on active duty with the Navy and fly airplanes. And it was a time where they weren't hiring a lot of people. They only hired, I think, selected two candidates on the West Coast that year, but I happened to be one of them. So got in there, went through all the training, and ultimately became, you know, flew in combat, flew off the ships, lots of flight time, and lots of teamwork, lots of leadership stuff, and then I was able to get into the astronaut corps. The experiences were phenomenal, not just from a technical or systems perspective, but operationally, and having to work with diverse teams and lots of people. And sometimes you don't have all the data. You know, we like to work in the known box where, you know, the decisions are easy because you kind of know what the right answer is. And sometimes the known unknown, you kind of get more into management. You have to think a little bit, but it's still fairly easy. You know, in aviation, a lot of times we work in the unknown unknown box, and we get to, you have to get very comfortable with just, hey, I don't know if it's left or right, but I'm going right, and we're going to see what happens. And you make a decision.
And with you always wanting to having the end goal of being an astronaut, do you think that that's still in a lot of kids today? I mean, you've probably have talked to young cadets coming up. Do you see a lot of hope for many people saying, I still, you know, a lot of people's coming forward, I still want to do this? Because, you know, I got to be honest, you know, talking to people my age, I don't hear a lot of, I'm going to be an astronaut. You know, I've had people tell me, you know, I want to be a sports star, or, you know, I want to own my own finance company or something. But astronaut, for some reason, just isn't in the pop culture as much anymore. Do you still see that, or do you think that it needs to be more addressed?
Well, human spaceflight obviously has taken a little bit of a quieter stance over the last decade or so, not as as visible to the human public as it used to be. But we're at a neater curve. We're at a very exciting time. We've got the commercial crew coming up. We've got ISS that's going to continue to operate, which we need to continue to operate. We're building Gateway. We need that to continue. We're going to start exploring the moon and more locations than just the few locations that we did before. And we're going to use the Gateway to launch some new vehicles off to Mars and deep space exploration. So there's a lot of exciting things. And when I go out and talk, you know, folks our age are kind of beat down a little bit. There's a lot going on in the world. There's a lot of things we have to take care of, and we got to fix. We got to make smooth. But all that being said, when I go into the elementary schools or the junior high schools or the high schools, and it doesn't matter where, it could be at the academy, and those folks are just absolutely fantastic. Those folks, there's a good number of those folks there that will make it, and they have huge interest in the space program. And even if they don't make it to the space program, they're going to be great officers and great aviators and great ship drivers and everything that comes with it. When I go into the vocational schools, you know, in some of the bad parts of town, those folks are just as interested, and they have just as much talent, and they're just as ready to support the space program. They're really excited about it. We just have to help them, help everybody just kind of achieve their dreams and know that they can achieve their dreams, and they'll do what they can do.
And you talked about the smiles you got. I mean, you could even see it with me. Look, when I went out to greet you outside the office, it's something about the blue suit. Do you get a lot of, you know, attention just walking around in the blue suit? A lot of people probably asking you questions all the time and things like that. Or is that kind of one of the cool experiences, I imagine?
I don't know if it's a cool experience. It's a different experience for sure. And it does bring a little bit of attention, especially outside of Houston. You know, in Houston, you know, it's kind of no big deal, but around the rest of the country, it does draw a little bit of attention. So we try to just kind of keep it quiet and out of the way. And a lot of the times we prefer to just disappear and enjoy a quiet lunch. But with the blue suit on, there's no such thing.
We're speaking with Scott Tingle. He's an astronaut with NASA. What is the question you get the most from, you know, public walking up to you?
What's your favorite food, you know, in space? You know, what do you miss most when you're not on Earth?
And the answer to both those questions?
Well, my favorite food, I tell them it's the PB&J tortilla, you know, which became a favorite on my ISS trip. And then the thing I miss the most is probably hot showers.
Oh, hot shower. Okay. Yeah. So hopefully wife doesn't hear this interview. Right?
No, that's a standard. You know, the real number one answer is the family.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. It's the way that the question is always couched is, okay, aside from your family, because they know we're going to say family. You know.
NASA astronaut Scott Tingle speaking with Federal News Radio's Eric White. In part two of the interview, Tingle outlines the importance of the International Space Station itself. I'm Tom Temin.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
After spending 168 days in space, NASA astronaut Scott Tingle got the full effect of returning to Earth and its gravity. He's one of many astronauts accumulating data about the effect on human health of long periods in space. In part two of his interview with Federal News Radio's Eric White, Tingle explains what it feels like landing on Earth after 6 months up there.
When I first felt the solid ground, it was with a huge crash because we came back in Soyuz and it hits the ground pretty hard. And it whacked my head pretty good. And I was actually kind of mad. I was like, God, because it really feels like somebody just hit you in the head, back of the head with a bat. And then after that, I was like, okay, we made it. The chute opened. Everything's good. And there's a little bit of a relief. And you're kind of waiting there. You have a lot of work to do in the cockpit and, you know, turning systems off and getting things back stable again so that you can open the hatch. And then you start hearing the knocking on the outside of the thing. You're like, oh, they're here already, you know. And then before you know it, you see the hatch starting to open. And as soon as the hatch opens, you get that rush of air. And you could smell the Kazakhstan desert and the vegetation and the dirt and everything there that you hadn't smelt in 6 months. And that experience is pretty cool. It only lasts about 30 seconds or a minute or so, but it's pretty cool. Getting out, it's kind of hard to kind of feel they're carrying you out for a reason. You know, our big muscles are really strong. Our small muscles that kind of keep us coordinated are kind of weak because they haven't been used a whole lot, and our spines are elongated, so we kind of don't have the stability that we would normally have. And so you're very careful, and you to take some time to adjust, which is why we're just sitting there drinking water and just kind of looking around and making sure that we're not going to, like, throw up or anything, and just taking it easy.
Is there anything you can compare it to? Is it like a long run or a long workout or something like that? Or is it just kind of just feeling a little off?
Well, it's like you've been on the ship for 6 months and you come back and the ground is moving. we call that sea legs in the Navy. But it's just a different feeling. It's there's nothing you can really compare it to other than if you've done 10 or 15 things that make you feel a little bit different when you step off onto the ground, whether it's being on a ship or being on a motorcycle or skydiving or being in an airplane or whatever it is, this is just going to be another different thing that's going to have its own unique things. And so the big thing when we come back is our middle ear is not aligned, and so it's really hard to maintain balance. After about being there for a half hour and sitting and hydrating and maybe eating some fruits and vegetables or whatever, we'll try to walk a little bit. And so you get a little bit wobbly, and you just got to take your time, and you really got to focus. And I equated that to flying airplanes aboard aircraft carriers at night, because sometimes you don't know which end is up. You're in the clouds. All you can see is a light bobbling around in the middle of the ocean, and you're supposed to land on it. And you really have to focus. And if your middle ear is telling you you're sideways, but your instruments are telling you you're straight, which is exactly how you feel when you land and you come out of the capsule, you have to disconnect your inner ear and start believing your instruments. And for me, my instrument was my eyesight, and I just had to focus. And I remember focusing really hard so that I could walk straight. And I did. I was successful. I did. I passed all the tests. I did really good coming back, and I didn't need a whole lot of help, but. It was an experience that reminded me about my first few nights landing at the ship.
So you took that one step at a time. Anything that you struggled with a little bit? You know, you were talking about some of the senses aren't quite up to, you know, back. They got to get back in queue. Was there anything that kind of was like, whoa, that's really shocking there? You know, how hot the shower actually is or something like that.
No, everything was pretty much as expected as I kind of thought it would be. I had enough strength. I just had to kind of work on my coordination. When you first get up to space, you have to go through an adjustment. And little something, like if you go to drop something, the first thing you're going to do is kneel down and try to grab it before it hits the floor. In space, you still go to do that, and then you realize, oh, it's not falling. I have to go up and do it. So you have a reaction that, you know, if you have time to think about the physics, you'll do the right thing every time. But if you have to react quickly and there's no thought process, you don't have those neuron paths built yet. And so it takes some time to adjust. And so you do all that adjustment, and now your body's running right, you're doing good in space, then you come back. And now you have to readjust. You have to figure that out. And it takes a little bit of time for your brain to actually figure out, okay, these are the right reactions that I have to have. It's a lot easier coming back than actually going up isn't too bad either. But, you know, it's just you already have the neuron paths built when you come back. So it's just you just have to re-energize them and make sure they're still working.
NASA astronaut Scott Tingle speaking with Federal News Radio's Eric White. I'm Tom Temin.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
You're listening to our interview with NASA astronaut Scott Tingle, speaking with Federal News Radio's Eric White.
Speaking of the space station, what is the importance of it? You know, a lot of talk of, you know, we can get into budgetary stuff if you want. We don't have to, of course. I'm lying. But, you know, a lot of people are saying, what is it up there? You know, it's either the moon or Mars or a bus for me. But why have this, you know, space station up there? What do you tell those people?
Yeah, so the energy it takes to get to the moon is, you know, 10 to 20 times more than it takes to just get to low Earth orbit and the International Space Station. The energy it takes to Mars is 10 times to 20 times more than what it takes to get to the moon. So getting to low Earth orbit and the International Space Station is fairly easy and fairly affordable if we manage it. And it provides a platform where we can use it as a test bed. We can do a lot of observation on the Earth. We can do a lot of observation of systems and experiments that we have outside the space station and inside the space station. And then we use it for outreach events. We motivate the next generation of space designers and travelers and scientists for that. And we're going to use it as a launching point to actually get to Gateway. We need it to actually test concepts, to test, you know, operations concepts. We need to test it, technical concepts for that. Any given time, we have 200 to 250 experiments going on the International Space Station. And one of them that I worked on was called metabolic tracking, or B-cell. And what it did is that we had a test tube with a medium in it, and we also had a substance that we would inject into the medium. And that substance had bioluminescent cells. And so when you hit it with a spectrometer, you know, a certain wavelength, those cells would actually illuminate, and you could see how they were interacting with the test media and see how they combined and how effective that the solution would become for whatever they were looking at. And what that means to people on Earth is that this is a great way to test new medicines to see if they're effective without having to go through a 1 or 2 year trial of checking for operational effectiveness and, you know, the outcome. You can just see it real time and you can make decisions. So we can get medicines cheaper and we'll be able to get them to the front line or to the people, much faster than that. And so that's a benefit. And that's one of a bazillion benefits that we can bring to the human race just by having that capability up on the International Space Station. For that, other things that we do, the outreach type events, you know, with STEM, we're constantly, working with schools. We're doing experiments I worked on an experiment called Rock Candy, and a bunch of school kids, middle-aged middle school kids, designed an experiment to squirt sugar and a substance into a bag and shake it up and then have it solidify in space. And it didn't work out exactly as they wanted, but we got some great pictures. We motivated. They did the experiment on Earth exactly the same time I was doing it on video with them up on the space station. And they tested out their theories, and they have a correction, and we'll probably try that one again, and with some recommendations on things that we can do better. But it was pretty cool. It was good to see that. And when I came back home, we went and saw some of those students. They had pictures, big smiles on their face, and they were so excited and motivated for doing science, especially. They actually built something that was on space station and came back from space station.
Yeah, and on those experiments, I mean, I imagine, people are saying, get us to Mars, come on, gas pedal down. But, what you're telling me is we do a lot of experiments that we're probably not going to be able to get to Mars without doing some of these. Are there any specific experiments that you can think of? Well, obviously, I'm sure you can, but tell me about some of the experiments that are there about showing the effect that space has on the human body when it endures, long-term stays in space.
Yeah, so we do a lot of human research while we're up there. Ourselves, the astronauts are the subjects. We take a lot of blood, we take a lot of urine, we take a lot of, everything from humans so that we can analyze, how it goes through its transitions from Earth to space and then long-term space and then space to Earth. One of the two of the biggest things that we look at are the fluid shifts. We've got a lot of fluid in our legs and in our abdomen, and it goes up into our heads a little bit more, and then it takes over time. Your body learns how to dehydrate it, and you kind of puff back down again, and some of us stay puffed up in orbit, so you just look like a marshmallow man up there, but that's part of the process. And your spine actually elongates while you're in space, because you don't have the gravity pulling you down, and so you actually get very comfortable. And if you have a bad back, you actually feel great.
Yeah.
I've got an aviator's back that's kind of struggling. I have to take care of it a little bit, but it's manageable. But when I got up on orbit, it felt great. I was able to lift weights like never before. I was able to run on the treadmill. I was feeling really good for that. But then when I got back home, it started to straighten, or not straighten out. You actually get the curvature back, and it shrinks, compresses back down. And it was fairly painful for a number of weeks. And that was it took a very serious reconditioning program that had to be the highest priority over everything else. To do that to the point, it was bad enough where you couldn't sleep more than a half hour.
NASA astronaut Scott Tingle speaking with Federal News Radio's Eric White. Hear the interview in its entirety at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Agency in Focus NASA, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus.